In the coming week, European leaders hold a summit on Greece-Turkey tensions in the Mediterranean. Italians prepare to head to the polls ahead of national referendum and regional elections. And the global world of sports stages major events under unusual conditions. It's September 17th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, in the week ahead, the body known as the Special European Council is set to meet in Brussels. It's going to discuss a wide range of issues, but the biggest one on the table seems to be the crisis unfolding in the Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean, that involves longtime foes Greece and Turkey, but a host of other nations, including Cyprus. So, Jim, can you give us a bit of background about what is going on?
Happy to, Bob. I would summarize the situation like this. Take some historical enmity, add in some national pride and a lot of money, and you get significant tensions. I think, as you know, there's no love lost between Greece and Cyprus on the one hand and Turkey on the other. Greece and Cyprus were ruled from Istanbul for centuries. Cyprus has been divided since 1974 after Turkey invaded Cyprus and created the Northern Republic of Cyprus. Now, the new development is that in recent years, there have been discoveries in the Eastern Mediterranean of potentially large and very lucrative natural gas fields and oil fields. The question then becomes one of who has the right to claim those fields and the wealth they can produce. And not surprisingly, we have conflicting claims. Last November, Turkey and Libya signed a deal creating an exclusive economic zone, abbreviated EEZ, stretching from Turkey's southern coast to Libya's northeastern coast. Now, Egypt and Greece immediately protested, arguing that the EEZ that the Libyans and the Turks had drawn up conflicted with their own claims. Since then, Germany has been trying to mediate a deal between the Greeks and the Turks. That effort stalled last month after Greece and Egypt signed a deal creating an EEZ that, not surprisingly, overlapped with Libya and Turkey's. The Turks responded by sending a survey ship into waters that Greece claimed. The survey ship was trailed by Greek and Turkish naval ships. And as those ships were shadowing each other, a Turkish naval ship collided with a Greek naval ship. Not surprisingly, tensions flared. Keep in mind that both Greece and Turkey are members of NATO. To add to the mix, France and Italy dispatched naval vessels to the area to show their solidarity with Greece and Cyprus. Italy and France are both members of the EU, as are Greece and Cyprus. Turkey is not a member of the EU. Now, some of the tensions in these waters have eased over the past week. And assuming this holds, I suspect that what you will see coming out of the European Union summit is some sort of communique in support of Greece and Cyprus. Again, both are members of the EU. I think the big question about the meeting is what kind of support is the EU going to offer? There have been divisions among EU members about how forward-leaning to be in support of Greece and Cyprus. Paris has favored a much tougher line, wants significant sanctions. Berlin, Madrid, and Rome have favored a softer tone. The result so far has been some minor sanctions on Ankara. You can think of them as essentially the diplomatic equivalent of finger wagging. But again, we'll see when this meeting concludes whether we get stiffer sanctions or just some sort of generic communique on the importance of sovereignty.
Wow, there's a lot of things to unpack there, Jim, but it among others is the NATO angle. Have we had any NATO meetings on this, since you have a number of NATO countries, not just Greece and Turkey, seem to be heavily involved in this, and it seems to cut at the core of or be part of an area where NATO has ramped up its presence recently, which is the Mediterranean, including the Eastern Mediterranean?
I'm not aware of any formal meetings that have been called to address this. My sense is that there's been a fair amount of behind-the-scenes diplomacy. One of the interesting things has been the role of, or perhaps better put, the lack of a role, at least visibly, of the United States in all of this. Traditionally, the United States, when disputes arose between Turkey and Greece, Washington weighed in and played the role of the mediator. They did so, for example, in the mid-1990s when we had another sort of flare-up of tensions between Greece and Turkey that some people at that point worried might escalate into conflict. In this particular case, Washington seems to be setting the stage, not just to the EU, but I think to Germany in particular. Now, there'd be private conversations going on between American diplomats and the Greeks and the Turks, but as best I can tell, there's been no sort of high-profile American diplomatic initiative on this score.
Another interesting plot line, Jim, you mentioned is the Libya-Turkey angle, because you have, in addition to all these riches in that area, you have the ongoing brokering of the Libyan civil war. Turkey has thrown its support behind, you know, one side of that. You have other major actors in Europe who've also been involved. Do we see any sort of impact on the Libyan diplomacy as part of this whole crisis unfolding?
I haven't seen any, Bob, but again, I think you're right to point this out. I think the Libyan issue is a particular thorn for the French, who have been, I think, very vocal in opposing what the Turks are trying to do in Libya. They're backing a different side in that. I think it's essentially a civil war. I don't know a better way to describe it. And so there have been tensions there. And again, there's a broader backdrop to all of this, which is that when there was talk of Turkey joining the EU, it was France that led the forces that basically said, this is not going to happen. And again, over the last decade, Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, has sort of taken the country in a different direction. I'm not trying to suggest it was simply because the French and other EU countries were opposed to Turkey joining the EU. But whereas once we thought maybe there was going to be a coming together, I think generally we're seeing sort of a pulling apart. And that's playing into this whole conversation here.
Jim, I want to stay in the neighborhood and turn our attention to Italy. It's holding a national referendum and also a series of regional elections in the coming week. The referendum and the regional elections are going to give us an opportunity for Italians to take stock of their center-left government, which is only a year old. But for our listeners who may not be up on their Italian politics, could you talk a little bit about what's behind the referendum, what's going on with these elections?
Sure, Bob. Italy has a bicameral parliament. It consists of a chamber of deputies, think of it as the lower house, and a Senate, the upper house. One thing to know about Italy's parliament and about this referendum is that the Italian parliament has lots and lots of members. There are 630 or so members of the chamber of deputies.
That's got to be one of the biggest ones in Europe, I would say.
It in fact is. And let me just put it in perspective, Bob. Italy has nearly 2.5 times as many national lawmakers as the United States, even though the United States has 5.5 times as many citizens. So that gives you a sense of how big.
So that's representative democracy, right?
It is very representative democracy. And as you point out, it's not just very large in comparison to the United States. It's very large in comparison to every other parliamentary democracy in Europe. And again, that's the point of the entire referendum. And if Italian voters approve, then the size of each chamber will be cut by about a third. You'll end up with 400 members of the Chamber of Deputies and about 200 senators. Now, the campaign for this referendum has been led by the Five Star Movement, a group we've talked about before on the podcast. The Five Star Movement, or the Five Stars, it is known, is the populist anti-establishment party that is part of the governing coalition in Italy, along with the center-left Democratic Party. Now, the referendum is expected to pass. Polls there show that the public strongly favors it, and none of the other parties have really opposed it. The decrease in the number of members of parliament would save Italy somewhere between 285 and 500 million euros for each five-year parliamentary term. So we're not talking about huge savings. But again, this has been one of the major efforts, initiatives of the Five Stars. But I think sort of the people who follow politics in Italy, what they're paying attention to is less the referendum than the 7 regional elections that are going to be held at the same time. The reason for this is the first vote in Italy since COVID-19 struck. Indeed, the referendum was originally scheduled for March 29th and had to be postponed because of the pandemic. But when political experts look at the regional elections, what they want to see is how well are the center-left parties doing versus the center-right and right-wing parties. Again, Italy currently has a center-left government. Italy has been battered by COVID-19. It has had one of the highest death tolls per capita of any country in the world. Things have improved substantially since the spring, but as is the case in the rest of the world, nobody is out of the woods quite yet. And so these regional elections will give us a sense of whether or not Italians think that their government has been doing a good enough job, or whether we're going to see a real shift to the center-right parties, particularly to the right party Lega.
Jim, do we have a sense whether Italy is feeling more confident about its ability to rest or at least keep the pandemic under control? Obviously, they're not dealing with the traumatic results that they had early on, which was, I think, almost gripping the world, kind of the scenes out of places like Bergamo. But do we have a sense that as they hold this election, is it going to be under sort of crazy conditions? Are people feeling a little more confident in Italy?
Well, Italy has opened back up, as has been the case in much of Europe. I was just looking at the figures posted on deaths around the world. In the last day, Italy hasn't reported any deaths, and the sort of case rate has fallen. However, Italy faces, again, the same situation other countries do, which is that the virus can flare up. And I think Italian medical authorities have learned a lot, as have medical authorities around the world, about how to try to slow down transmission. But the reality is, as it gets cooler, people move back indoors, you can continue to see flare-ups. This is the problem, again, everyone is having to deal with. And that's why the referendum is sort of seen as an attempt to look and see, you know, what do Italians think about what their government is doing. Now, again, the key component is the regional elections, and it's only in seven regions in Italy, and the conditions vary from each region. Obviously, people, when they go to vote, aren't voting just on COVID-19 or how COVID-19 has affected their lives. They're all sort of local issues. But I think people, when the polls close in Italy, are going to be sort of looking at that and saying, what does that tell us about the current mood of the Italian people? Are we seeing a move back to right-wing parties? Again, if you were to go back a year ago, a lot of the speculation was that Lega was going to actually maneuver within the Italian parliament and become the dominant party. That didn't happen. But again, if you start to have a different movement in local elections, you could see momentum building up for Lega in the future.
That last point is very interesting, Jim, and especially as we continue to look at elections in places where you have seen populist surges. How is the pandemic affecting populism? Populist leaders don't seem to be embracing science, shall we say, in many cases, but that doesn't necessarily seem to have hurt them in some areas. Verdict's still out in the U.S., obviously, but like Brazil, Bolsonaro's personal popularity seems to be still very high while he has been dismissive of the pandemic and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent we can glean that kind of information from the Italian results.
That's certainly the case, Bob. But if I may, I want to change topics to something we talked about a few weeks ago, namely protests by athletes, particularly in the NBA and the WNBA, in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. At that time, we also began to discuss the impact of the coronavirus on the resumption of sports around the globe. And it might be useful to return to that topic. We have upcoming Grand Slam events in golf and tennis. We're just wrapping up the Tour de France. And the Big Ten has announced it's going to go back to the football field at the end of October. So can you talk, Bob, a little bit about how global sports leagues and teams have adapted to COVID-19?
For me, Jim, the global sports is a fascinating experiment, a carve-out, if you will, in the otherwise still pretty much halted movement of people around the world. And, you know, you have basically tourism pretty much shut down, global tourism. You have diplomacy and arrested. You have the UN opening up next week at the General Assembly debate, and it's going to be a virtual debate, for example. And lots of other ways in which people are not interacting internationally, but they are in sports. Not only that, the competition is good, and it almost seems a little bit more might feel guilty to be taking pleasure in sporting events, but I think it actually does something. And even while the opening up of sports has become controversial for all sorts of reasons, including some of the social justice reasons you cited earlier, as well as the Big Ten move, for example, where people are seeing the privileging of athletes over other students because of special guidelines set in place and so forth, it's still becoming, as the world is trying to sort out the way it can somehow recapture normalcy, sports is becoming a very interesting laboratory for this, Jim. So So we just had the U.S. Open, for example, and the opening of some of the college football season with these eerily silent or nearly empty stadiums. You know, the U.S. Open in New York, for example, some incredible matches. I caught the last batch from the semifinals onward. And you would normally have heard, you know, in addition to the jets flying over landing at LaGuardia, you have been hearing people screaming out and rousing cries after various points, even though they're supposed to be silent during the actual serve and volley part of matches. That wasn't there. And yet the competition level was pretty phenomenal on both the men's and women's sides. And then in NBA as well, I think you've had a league increasingly international. You have an astounding number of great European and African athletes in addition to American ones who are predominating in the playoffs right now. And so the NBA, for example, I think offers the bubble concept. You had a league in a situation that where officials are most able to kind of control things. And so they brought everybody together in this bubble in Orlando, Florida, and controlled through rigorous testing and through distancing practices and so forth, and controlling of who could be in the bubble and how long people had to stay there. They pretty much tamped down any sort of outbreak of virus. It's been remarkable. We've seen somewhat similar results in hockey, where you've had two bubbles, a sort of an East and West bubble in Canadian cities. You've still had heavy controls at the U.S. Open in tennis. You're going to see this in France. Now, what's going to be interesting with the French Open coming up starting next week, Jim, is that they are allowing fans, limited numbers, but still fans, up to 20,000, I think, will be able to attend in the course of those events with strictures in place. France has been hosting a France-only Tour de France bike race in which you had much more distance between the spectators and the cyclists. Typically, Tour de France, people familiar with it, are these incredible scenes in like the Pyrenees where these racers are racing through and there's crowds right there, you know, sort of feeling their pulsing energy and so forth and touching the athletes. None of that is happening now. Tour de France is continuing though. We're entering into the final stage with the Slovenian Primo Roglic is in the lead with the yellow jersey. So that's going to be very interesting. You have another golf major taking place in the United States in Westchester County, the Winged Foot, which is the U.S. Open. Again, great athletes from around the world competing in that. For me, it provides, it's this sense of being able to see international figures appearing together, which has been rare during this 6 months or so of lockdown. And yet it's also fraught with all sorts of issues of, are there double standards in society and why are we letting sports proceed this way and say, you know, education forums not?
Certainly. I should note that my question to you, I didn't even note the sport that is the most popular one in the United States, which is professional football. And the National Football League started again just last week. And most stadiums were empty, except I think for Jacksonville. And that's because different laws in different states about where people can congregate and the like. But I'm curious, you know, we talked about this topic earlier this summer. We talked about it in the context of protests for racial inequality here in the United States. And obviously, what was interesting about that is you were seeing those protests overseas as well, both in solidarity to what had happened to George Floyd, but also because people have their own racial issues in other countries. The United States is not the only country that struggles with race. And I'm just curious, as you sort of watch these events sort of spin up, are we seeing the same level of protests as we saw before, or have things moved on?
I think internationally, from what I've seen, and I'm going to be watching things like the French Open pretty closely, not as much. Sports not as being much of an arena for that kind of expressiveness. As you're seeing in the U.S., you're still in the NBA, for example, and you catch any playoff game, and you're seeing all the athletes wearing jerseys bearing social justice slogans, for example. And not only athletes, you're seeing it in referees, and you're seeing it in coaches and so forth. You're seeing demonstrations before football games and the pro level, moments of silence, I should say, or kneeling during the national anthem.
I would note that the NFL's attitude toward protests before games has changed remarkably.
Yes.
Compared to the way it handled Colin Kaepernick's kneeling in protest.
That's right. You know, he became for several years persona non grata and is by many respects, a top level athlete doesn't seem to be able to have a chance to try out for teams. He did try out last year for some teams and that didn't go anywhere, but in general was vilified for a while after he spoke out on the issue of police violence against blacks. And that issue just, you know, crescendoed this year and has continued to since the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis, Jim.
Well, I will note that Colin Kaepernick continues to be vilified by many people, at least judging by what I see on Twitter. I'm curious, Bob, do we have any sense of how the public is responding to the resumption of sports? Are people tuning in to watch the games? Are people upset that sports is resuming when the rest of life isn't? I'm sort of curious because, again, I'm a big fan of college football, and what I have seen are a lot of protests, actually fairly small, but a lot of talk about how we have to have football, brings us back to normal. President Trump weighed in on the question of whether the Big Ten should resume football. And when the Big Ten presidents announced yesterday they would, I think President Trump took credit for it. So this is sort of not just a sports issue, it's become a political issue. Do we have any sense of how the public feels about all of this?
Yeah, I think in the Big Ten issue in particular, the response is still playing out, and it's been very much of those dual sides, Jim. It's excitement at football's back. You're hearing this excitement from the athletes themselves for understandable reasons, but also fans. But, also a bit of concern. You're having, Big Ten schools in particular were hit with some major outbreaks of COVID-19 among student body in the thousands by last reports I saw. And yet these are students who are not going to be afforded the sort of rigorous testing that the athletes will allow them to get on the field. It's also been pointed out that a lot of the Big Ten programs are in states that are going to be swing states, expected to be swing states in this fall's presidential election. And will that have any bearing on, the resumption and the role of the president in the resumption? Will that have any bearing on how people are going to vote? It's hard to see. It's one of these issues where the divide in the country hits on a knife edge for Americans. And it's going to be very interesting to see how they go forward, how this particular season is affected. We're still seeing outbreaks playing out at colleges that have resumed football already. I think LSU reported a large number of its players testing positive. So I think in particular that it's things like college athletics, Jim, where this is playing out. From what I saw, there were decent viewing numbers for the NFL games, even with the stripped down, different approach, unusual season, everything else. I do think there is a real desire for people to see NFL, hugely popular sport, and other sports too. People need to think back to their early part of this pandemic. There were a couple months where there was nothing going on. I mean, there was nothing happening, especially in the U.S. And the U.S. has struggled, as we've discussed on this podcast a lot, Jim, continued to struggle. And how it in providing a concerted response to the pandemic. We just had the unusual spectacle yesterday of the head of the CDC and the president giving opposing views on the importance of wearing masks, for example. It's not even an issue in a place like South Korea, where, by the way, fans have been allowed to go back and attend baseball stadiums recently, and where in Europe, where, soccer leagues, some of the biggest in the world, were allowed to play in their own stadiums. So it all trickles down from that, I think, Jim, and it's all part of the broader national debate. People do like having sports. As a sports fan, again, as I'm kind of looking at the laboratory involved as well as the actual sports themselves at this time.
Well, as a big sports fan, Bob, I'm happy to see sports come back, but I remain very concerned about where we're going with COVID-19 in this country. And as you rightly point out, until we can get it under control, none of these things are really going to return to normal.
Yeah, I mean, if I put my Pollyanna hat on, Jim, I would hope that potentially in some way sports and the role of sports reopening can help provide a pathway back for the whole country to get back on its feet and start sort of rowing in the same direction. Admittedly, that seems to be pretty far off at this point.
Yeah, I actually fear it's going to be the opposite way around, that sports is going to be added to the list of things that have become heavily politicized. I never would have thought that Big Ten football would become an issue in a presidential election and have people talking about how it might shift votes in the upper Midwest one way or the other. So it's a very different world since the coronavirus hit. Bob, let's move on to our figures of the week. Who or what is your figure this week?
Yeah, my figure is a person, and his name is Paul Rusesabagina. Now, for those who might not be too familiar, he rose to prominence during the dark period of the Rwanda genocide when he stepped forward and helped save an estimated hundreds of lives of Tutsis by allowing them shelter in his hotel where he was a manager. And he was elevated to broader fame by the 2004 movie Hotel Rwanda. He was depicted by the actor Don Cheadle, basically showing his efforts during the genocide to save Tutsis, what he had to go through, sticking out his own neck to save them. He is a Hutu himself, an ethnic Hutu. And yet he has been at odds for years with the ruling Tutsi party, especially its leader, Paul Kagame, in Rwanda. Why do I have him as figure of the week? Well, he was arrested just this past week under charges of plotting terrorism. is in Rwanda. His family says that he was actually kidnapped in Dubai several weeks ago and taken to Rwanda. He has got an interesting stature at the moment. He's a Belgian citizen. He also holds a U.S. green card. So it's going to be another test for Rwanda as it prosecutes his case, to the extent to which they will take a hard line or not against him. The track record of the Kagame government has not been encouraging on this front, and if you are concerned about human rights in Rwanda. And we've talked previously about Rwanda, Jim. It's one of these tough cases where you had Kagame, you know, ruling with an iron hand, absolutely lifting the country out of its morass and saying and justifying some of his steps as necessary to tamp down the level of enmity and hatred that had led to genocide. And a few ways you can point to what he's done, you know, in terms of economically, in terms of the role of women. There are an extraordinary number of women parliamentarians in Rwanda. And yet his human rights record is bad, especially when it deals with opposition political figures. So we'll have to see how Mr. Rusesabagina's case is carried forward to this point, but it's quite a change in fortune for someone who had been held up as a hero.
It most certainly has been, Bob.
Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure?
I'm going to go with a number, Bob. My number is 233, as in today is the 233rd anniversary of the signing of the United States Constitution. 233 years ago today, the framers wrapped up what had been a more than 3 month long discussion of how to reconfigure the Articles of Confederation. That's the purpose they started out with. They ended up jettisoning the Articles of Confederation in creating the system of government we now know, with a president, a Congress of two chambers, and a separate independent judiciary. And the story is told that when the Constitutional Convention wrapped up, that Ben Franklin, who then was in his 80s and had been a delegate to the convention, was exiting the hall, and a woman asked him, you know, what have you created? And he said, a republic if you can keep it. And I think that over the past 233 years, we've been able to fulfill Franklin's admonition, not without some trying times. And obviously, I think it is pretty safe to say that today we are amidst another period of trying times for the Constitution and the values embodied therein.
A very timely figure indeed, Jim, and having just visited prior to the pandemic what was purported to be the room where it happened, or at least where much of the Constitution was written up by James Madison, especially thrilled to note this anniversary. So I'm going to take note of it again and familiarize myself with what was happening back then. Because it was, as we've discussed also on this podcast, it's people do forget how rancorous this country was at times, especially around the founding era, and what happened to bring it together and create a country that for 233 years at least has been quite a success story.
I think that's actually a really good point, Bob. I think we tend to forget how periodically in the course of our history, the country has been divided as to where it wants to go and who it wants to lead it. And it is remarkable. If you go about a decade after the signing of the Constitution, the United States was really quite divided, with the followers of Jefferson and Madison accusing people like the esteemed George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and the like of being monarchists who were enthralled to Great Britain, whereas you had people like Washington and Adams and Hamilton firing back. So being in a period in which people are very angry at one another and are accusing each other of great misdeeds, it is not unheard of in our history. And hopefully we will be as successful going forward as we have been in the past navigating that. You know, obviously, the one great exception where we weren't able to navigate that peacefully was the Civil War, which remains sort of a great wound on the history of the United States.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The UN General Assembly holds a meeting to mark 25 years since the Beijing Women's Conference. And Puerto Ricans mark 3 years since Hurricane Maria devastated the island.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that the opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.